All right, hello. You are tuned into Warning Shots here on CKUW 95.9 FM. Warning Shots is CKUW's international news show. Right now, I am joined with Professor Ian Mackay. Ian Mackay is a Canadian historian, specifically a historian of the Canadian left and other left movements around the world. Thank you for joining me, Ian.
Oh, my pleasure.
Because of your background and kind of a lot of the work and research you've done, I wanted to get you some of your analysis and commentary on some of the things going on right now. Now, more specifically, with the Occupy Wall Street movement that's happening. Just about that. I mean, do you think the Occupy Wall Street movement will be able to actually have any effect on policies, or at the very least have an effect on kind of left-wing movements or groups right now?
It's very early to say, but I think the Occupy Wall Street movement deserves a lot of credit simply for raising issues that are of interest to the majority of people on the planet. And what they've really made unmistakably clear is just the crisis of capitalism that we're entering. Really, it started off with the subprime crisis, but now is intensified to a crisis of whole nation states. And this is really quite a moment of seismic change in the world in which we live. So I would agree that with some of its critics, that the Occupy Wall Street movement hasn't come up with a very tight list of demands, nor does it have a very focused movement that can take these demands forward. But right now, I think what really deserves our attention is just how emphatically they have gripped the public's attention in a way that can't be avoided. And I think if I were in elected office, I would be watching this movement very carefully and noticing that people are really fed up with the world as it's evolving economically.
Hmm.
It really raised that issue profoundly, and I would suggest that what we're really going through is a very fundamental structural change in the system that will affect every one of us. Whether this leads to a kind of depression, some new kind of economic crisis, it's hard to say. And obviously the political outcomes of anything like that are also difficult to predict. But let's give them maximum credit for raising a kind of progressive critique of this, I would say, the climax of two decades of irresponsible economic thinking on the part of our establishment.
But now, do you think it would, I mean, because a lot of your work talks about the legacy of a lot of different, you know, left-wing movements and kind of what they were able to accomplish. What do you think the Occupy Wall Street movement would have to do to have any kind of lasting legacy? I mean, is it just simply about bringing specific objectives, or is it more about them being around for a long time to be able to get a sort of a legacy?
I think with any of these movements, the first great moment takes people aback because they can't quite see where it's going. This is true of any big historical movement that we know, and we'll just have to see. But I think it's a little premature to say, well, they should be creating a party, or they should be creating a very coherent, consistent set of demands. Because I think right now what they're articulating is something more fundamental, which is a tremendous discontent with the system under which we live. Sooner or later, this will, if it is to leave a lasting impact, will have to generate some kind of institution, some kind of party, some kind of more consistent, coherent movement. But right now, people are going through what I would call a kind of moment of epiphany, or a moment of supersedure, as Gramsci would call it, in which people are just waking up to the magnitude of this crisis, and they're realizing that it's going to affect everyone who lives in a Western capitalist country. There will be no safe place in any of this. Where you take that perception is a really vital question for everyone to ponder. I think people should take that perception to their unions. I think they should be creating a much more dynamic peace movement, because one of the great issues around the economic crisis is how much money has been wasted in senseless armaments expenditure. How much of this crisis is really driven by two reckless wars that the U.S. and their allies waged in Iraq and Afghanistan? You know, trillions upon trillions of dollars down the drain for these wars that basically is a drag on the entire economy and a waste of ideals and a waste of energy. That's where I think this movement really should take up a new direction and galvanize the peace movement again. Make sure that the peace movement takes up these issues and fights them in every context in which it can. Because I think that the war and peace issue is one that really can't be overstated in this present moment. And look at how, almost to distract our attention from the terrible mess they've made of the economic order, we're being drawn into this new militarism, a discourse of war, perpetual war, fought against enemies all around the planet. And in a way, this is to make us not think about the underlying irrationality of the system.
Now, kind of to the point you were kind of talking about, how, you know, it's premature to say that they should be a little more cohesive or form a party. I read in a recent column, Chantal Hibert of the Toronto Sun wrote a column saying that, you know, basically that the Occupy Wall Street movement should take action to the ballot box, not to the streets. And she suggested that they should get NDP memberships and affect the NDP leadership race if they really want to change something. Do you agree with this?
I would agree with it very partially. I think Chantal Hibert sort of sees as one thing that people could do that might be imaginative and constructive, and that is to take this movement to the NDP and basically hold the NDP to account and say, as a social democratic party, surely these are your values that are being fought for in the Occupy Wall Street moment. What are you going to do concretely that's going to live up to our ideals? And if you don't, you know, if a candidate doesn't sort of have something to say about that, then vote for somebody else. Find a candidate that will really push that. I think that's one imaginative thing you can do with this new impetus. But, you know, that's only a fractional thing. And in many ways, we need a much more all-inclusive strategy. We almost need to think of new ways of constructing the left movement that will, sure, have room for parliamentary struggle, but a great deal of it is actually not going to take place inside the House of Commons at all or inside the official parties. It'll take place in a much more broad-ranging movement that will have to have many, many other avenues besides Parliament. So I think, you know, Chantal Hibert maybe makes a good point about one useful thing that protesters can do, and that is to take it to the social democratic parties and say, you know, we want results from you. But that's just one thing, and I think more demonstrations, much more energized peace movement, and new ways of having these movements coalesce. I mean, lots of ways that this is already starting to happen, right, with new forms of movement building that really draw the strengths of each particular movement but try and build them into something else. So I think, you know, she's being a little bit too narrow with that prescription.
Also, you know, in thinking about that kind of the issue that she raises, I mean, the thing that kind of came to my mind is, are we giving the NDP maybe a little too much credit in the sense of they're not that far off in a lot of cases in policies to the other parties? I mean, it's not as if they're anti-austerity, it's more or less austerity light, you know what I mean? So it's is the NDP really the place to push forward this sort of agenda, you know?
So much depends on your local NDP, on what kind of baggage people are carrying. I agree that the NDP right now is not altogether clear on a lot of important issues that people need clarity on. For example, on the issue of war and peace, we find the NDP, having voted for the Paul Martin rearmament budget, as now sort of having very little that is critical or incisive to say about the new worships. I find that disappointing. And I think in a lot of these areas, the NDP has to be confronted with a mobilized rank and file. Because, you see, I think the contradiction of the NDP is there's a lot of progressive people in the NDP who genuinely want a different world and genuinely agree with the people who are occupying Wall Street. So often their voices get muffled as the party, you know, seeks respectability and seeks office and waters down more and more and more what its rank and file really wants to see it achieve. And this is a long-standing pattern, but it's not an unbeatable pattern. People can fight it within the party. And I think, you know, having this leadership campaign over the next 6 months or so, that's a great time to raise some of these issues. And really say, you know, the NDP says it represents a different way of doing politics, says it represents social justice movement, says it represents peace. Okay, candidates, show us the money. What are you concretely going to do to push these within the NDP? But I agree with you that the NDP is not the primary focus. That actually it's outside the NDP in all these broad social movements, in trade unions, in the peace movement, in the environmental movement, that this new sensibility has to take hold. And it's the NDP, if it's wise, will realize that it has to fit in within this much bigger movement of movements if it really wants to make a difference. The other alternative is that the NDP just turns into another left liberal party on the image of the Labour Party in Britain. And at least that would clarify our options, because I don't know many people that think that was a great success in changing the world. I think the dilemma of the NDP is that it's up against a fundamental, huge, worldwide structural contradiction in the way that capitalism has evolved. It calls upon the NDP to think fundamentally through underlying economic and social questions that crisis is going to create. And I'm not sure that the NDP has done its homework on this kind of issue. So if it's going to come up and speak meaningfully to this moment in history, it really has to change.
Now, having said that, I mean, you've spent a lot of your academic career kind of looking at these sorts of things. Historically, though, are political parties really that fluid to be able to, you know, embrace at least, you know, these kind of mass protest movements, or, you know, these kind of this mass mobilization? It seems to me that political parties are a little more of a monolith than being fluid.
They get stuck in their groove and then they can't change.
Yeah.
I think you put your finger on an important point, and it depends on how much pressure is brought to bear on the party and how clever and imaginative it is within itself. And so far, I think the jury is still out on the NDP. The NDP did, in the 60s, make a reasonably good transition to being an exponent of many peace and environmentally conscious values in the 60s. So it started off as a very Cold War party in the 1950s and, carried away a lot of that baggage. As the 1960s unfolded and the struggle against Vietnam unfolded, the NDP came more and more on side with progressives outside the NDP. It had to. And I would say the same thing happened with the feminist movement in the 70s and 80s. The NDP was almost required to take account of feminism. It almost was forced to say, well, we can't have an old boys club anymore because that's just not going to be on in the wider world. If we want to get anywhere, we have to incorporate feminist demands in our central program. We have to have women involved in our executive in a central and powerful way. We can't just go on the same way. I think they need to make that same kind of accounting now in a moment of global economic crisis. They've done it before to a point, and if they want to survive, they're going to have to do it again. Otherwise, yes, there will be new parties and new movements supersede the NDP.
Wow. Well, that's interesting. Now, I guess kind of looking forward, it seems that, I mean, now, like you said, it's sort of this moment of epiphany for some people, and that's why it's kind of hard to grasp, and it's been hard to, for people, I guess, to get a bearings on what's going on. But the other question always comes up is that, I guess for years, people have always been saying that the left is kind of done and out. Do you think it's this is sort of a resurgence, in a sense, of progressive ideas? Yes,
I don't think you need to go very far in the world to find people who think that the economic system and the social system ushered in by neoliberalism has been a tragic error. That the post-war compromise after 1945, Keynesianism, all of these things, that having been undone, you've removed the basic buffers from the system, and you're now in a situation where you have classically revolutionary distributions of income, where, you know, tiny percentages of the population hold massive amounts of wealth. So you don't need to be a leftist even to notice that you can't pay the rent very easily. You have to work all the time in order to maintain your income. Working class standards of living have not really risen since the 1970s. People are in a really crunch situation. And you're starting to hear from the mainstream all kinds of people who are saying, you know, why don't we just, say, nationalize some of the banks? These aren't socialists. These are like mainstream people, because they're noticing that the banks are basically failing in their function of distributing credit within the system. If they're not able to do it, well, practically speaking, why don't we find another way of getting credit into the system? And these aren't like far-left people at all saying this. These are quite mainstream folks who are saying, you know, there's something quite insane about the way the world financial system is evolving. Can we not find reforms to adjust it? And I think that's, to start hearing that talk outside the institutions and the sort of the normal suspects of the left, you're starting to hear it a lot in mainstream media. So I think that's really telling. I also think that in Canada we're dealing with a much more cohesive, aggressive, intelligent, and ruthless far-right regime. And this far-right regime is going to clarify things pretty fast for people who are still sitting on the fence and hoping that, you know, we can elect a sensible government and maybe make a difference, or we can moderate these people. These people are not going to be moderated. They're going to trash the wheat board. They're going to bring us into more and more wars. And they are governed by a far right-wing ideology that becomes clearer and clearer as longer they're in power. I'm not saying that this is a good thing. It's a terrible thing. But at least if you're going to say something good about it, you say, well, it's clarifying everybody's ideological options. And if you're against this, well, you're going to have to be just as tough and consistent and clear as they are. You can't go into this in a kind of muddle-headed way and say, well, let's fix this problem, or let's fix that problem, or let's... It's not actually going to work that way. You're going to have to start thinking in terms of structures and how you're going to change these structures.
Well, we'll have to leave it there.
Well, it's been great to talk to you.
Yes. Well,
you know, I remember the old Chinese proverb, may you live in interesting times, and these are very interesting times.
Yeah, no doubt. It seems every day you wake up and there's something new going on, or you know, the way things are developing. It certainly is fascinating times. And I thank you again, Ian MacKay, for coming on and giving some of your analysis and thoughts of this very interesting, fascinating time in which we live right now.
Okay, my pleasure.
Yes, thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye.